your operation here is more profitable than the separate accounting is going to provide larger revenues. But if your operation here is less profitable than worldwide, then you pay less revenues than the separate accounting. So again, it focuses in on your profitability here rather than your worldwide profitability. And so you have to make a judgment as to whether you want to key your tax simply upon the profitability that exists in your state.
Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I want to just kind of go back a little bit to try to refresh my memory. So in 1981, you were hired by the special, by the Joint Committee on Oil and Gas. Is that correct?
That's correct.
To come up with some type of legislation that...
To deal with the goals that were stated in that joint statement that I mentioned. And we had recommended the backstop proposal.
You had recommended the back. What were all the considerations that were undertaken to come up with that recommendation, if that's a fair comment?
Okay.
Going back quite a little ways, though, if you understand what I'm...
Yeah, the considerations was, one, this would allow us not to disturb the basic policy decision that had already been made in terms of enacting separate accounting versus abandoning it and going to something totally new. We also felt that, again, by abandoning separate accounting and going to something else, you might be just trading one lawsuit for another so that you haven't gained any more in terms of legal certainty. We felt that keeping the existing tax and backstopping with a tax that we felt was fairly secure legally, a tax which had sufficient fiscal horsepower so that it would totally backstop the separate accounting statute, so that, and it could be adjusted so that we didn't overcollect or undercollect, so it wouldn't have any effect on future exploration and development. And there wouldn't be any loss of revenues. It would keep separate accounting and would protect the state against any loss of revenue if the separate accounting statute was struck down. So those were sort of the considerations that led us to conclude that that was the best method of achieving the goals of the joint statement in 1981.
The joint statement made by the leadership, the governor, it was your interpretation. Joint statement of the legislature and the administration together. What's your role now? You're a private attorney?
Yes, I'm a lawyer in private practice in Anchorage.
Have you had a chance to sit and evaluate that recommendation? I mean, would you today recommend the same thing that you recommended in 1981? Do you think it?
Yes, I think I would. I mean, in terms of, again, taking the basic policy, if the legislature wants to keep the basic policy decision of separate accounting, wants to reaffirm that decision and protect the revenues in the event of that small risk that you might have to pay that back, that if you adopt if you were to reimpose separate accounting, I think the legislature should take a strong look at a backstop type approach.
It's also your opinion, and Mr. Erickson worked with you, is that,
yes.
Is that correct? In 1981, that to take the alternative proposal that the oil companies apparently were proposing was going to result in a substantial decline in revenues, is that correct?
Yes.
And the figure that you gave us was what? I don't know if I got that.
Yeah, I think Mr. Erickson had estimated at the time that the revenue loss from 81 through 85 was close to $600
million. 81 to 85 is $600 million?
Yes.
No, not right now.
Representative Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You said the fiscal note was $141 million. Was Erickson's figures of $600 million available also at the same time?
Yes, I think... yes, Mr. Erickson's estimate was July 10th, 1981, and the Department of Revenue's estimate, two estimates, one made in first fiscal note in June of 81, and a second estimate made on July 16th of 1981, which was fairly close to the second.
That's what I'm saying is, continue, Mr. Chairman, is the Mr. Erickson's estimates were those done after the bill was enacted or before the...
I believe that this was done after the bill was enacted. Shortly thereafter.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
If I might just respond to the question indirectly. The information from Mr. Erickson was available to legislators before the bill was enacted.
Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I apologize if this is probably pretty hard to all remember, but I just kind of wanted to go back a little bit into those years. remember my question now. Well, the question which Representative Pignalberry asked you had made the statement about the agreement that there would be a settlement of the suit if a certain type of legislation was enacted that went along the lines of what the oil companies apparently were interested in. And Representative Pignalberry asked you for the differences between what was finally done and what their proposal was. I think you said two things. One, the investment tax credit was deleted.
That's correct.
And that was deleted on the floor of the House, as I understand. Is that correct? Initially?
Initially, yes.
Initially. The second was a change in the economic limit factor.
Yes.
Is there any way, did you ever analyze or has ever been an analysis done as to what the revenue impact of those two changes were? For example, as I'm trying to say, the original projection by Mr. Erickson was $600 million. Is there an analysis of what the revenue impact to those two changes might have had?
There was a fiscal analysis that was done of the industry proposal as well as what passed. And I think you have those in your packet too. I think there was an analysis done by Milt Barker from Legislative Finance. I think Mark Widow also did an analysis of the settlement proposal. So you might compare those two fiscal analysis, one of the settlement proposal and one of what ultimately prepared, what finally passed.
Okay, I haven't had time to look at that. So what you're saying is we have available here in our packet Mr. Erickson's projection of $600 million. Mr. Whittle's proposal is what finally passed?
I think both of what finally passed and also with regard to the industry proposal.
Regarding to the industry proposal, so we can... Okay, I'll look for it. I don't need to pin you down because that information you may not have off the top of your head, but I would be interested. Also, well, that's fine. I think, Representative Cotton, you have the minutes you said of that meeting. Is that correct?
Thank you. We'll be probably calling you back a little later. At this time, I'd like to call on people that would like to testify.
Thank you.
The first one the chair will call is Dick Weaver with Dixon. State your name for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Richard Weaver. I'm area manager for Exxon Alaska, and I do appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 353. My remarks will not relate to the specific provisions of the bill. Rather, I'd like to comment on the effects of the bill, a bill which reverses the position taken by the state in 1981 regarding taxation on the oil and gas industry. In our view, the very introduction of this bill introduces additional risks to be considered in making investment decisions about Alaska. The bill also seems to say that this legislature views increases in taxation on the oil and gas industry as a substitute for fiscal constraint during periods of declining revenues, even when the reasons for the state's declining revenues affect our industry in very much the same way. Since 1981, and until the introduction of this legislation, the state has indicated a recognition for a need for a predictable tax climate. That favorable economic climate has encouraged investment by the oil and gas industry in costly and sometimes marginal projects. As a result, we have made some major investments in projects to improve the recovery from existing oil fields and to allow new production to come on stream. These investments do not have the economic attractiveness of a Prudhoe Bay scale development, but they do permit significant incremental production to be added to the reserves of the state. For example, at Prudhoe Bay, we are adding enhanced oil recovery projects, and work is under progress to bring the West End project on stream. Similarly, the Lisburn and Endicott projects are moving ahead to realization. Additional tax burdens and uncertainties, as generated by the introduction of this bill, compound the negative economic impacts of today's world oil price outlook and could well make some of these projects unattractive at this time. Our industry makes investment decisions on a money-forward basis, and I can assure you that the projects under consideration for future development will be very definitely including an assessment of the state's tax policy. Just as the effect of the state's position since 1981 in supporting a stable tax climate has resulted in added investment for production, a return to a less favorable climate may well have a chilling effect upon investment in new projects, particularly those which are marginally economic in today's price environment. An additional concern we have is that the major disruptions in the investment tax climate, as represented by this bill, gives the wrong signal to the general business community. This comes at a time when the state should be encouraging a diversified economic development. As an example, the legislature and the administration has taken as a priority the development of natural gas reserves on the North Slope. Studies have been commissioned on the disposition of the gas. In the light of the sentiment expressed by this type of legislation, what confidence can potential investors have that they would be allowed a predictable return on that investment? The administration and members of the legislature are also encouraging development in major mining projects within the state, and the state money may be invested in these projects. Developments which do not presently include substantial severance taxes or royalty payments. What assurance do the developers of these mineral projects have that after they have made their commitments and investments, that the state will not decide to change its tax policy and add severance and other special taxes in order to assure the state receive a fair share of the developments? These concerns come at a time when the state most needs additional diversification and can least afford to lose projects which provide future revenues for Alaska. And I might point out the obvious. The loss or the postponement of development projects within the oil and gas industry or elsewhere will translate into lost job opportunities for Alaskans. I would also address the discussions that the state revenues following the 81 tax change have been less than the legislature anticipated because the data supplied by the oil companies to the Department of Revenue was somehow misleading. Speaking for Exxon, I can say we supplied accurate, factual data to the department in 1981 using the assumptions given to us at the time. As we recall the debate on the tax issue, the states focused on the tax model was to minimize the state's risk in the income tax litigation while assuring the state a fair share of oil revenues. That fair share concept was defined by the legislature and the administration to be 30% of the total petroleum revenues. The present tax laws has met that requirement. At least as far as Exxon is concerned, our payments to the state have been substantially greater than 30% in each of the ensuing years. In closing, I might note that both the oil industry and the state of Alaska have undergone similar problems over the past few years. Like the state, the industry has seen its revenues fall since 1981. The industry's response to that period of falling prices has been to exercise fiscal restraint. For example, my company has reduced manpower by 17% below our 81 level. We have carefully reevaluated our capital projects in the view of our mid and long-term gain. We have looked very hard at our organization and our management processes from the top to the bottom to make them more efficient and competitive. And we have made adjustments in our activities. For example, we've reduced our tanker fleet and the number of refineries we operate by 25%, while at the same time investing in more efficient facilities and equipment which better meet long-term efficient operating objectives necessary to be competitive. The state is not a business as Exxon is, but it has been impacted by the same pressures. Fiscal restraint, not increased taxes, is the correct strategy for Alaska, now and in the long term. Finally, we believe the consideration of the separate accounting legislation at this time, when litigation of a similar tax is still ongoing, is inappropriate. The constitutionality and legal questions of the original Chapter 21 tax have not been resolved. The attempt by this legislature to reimpose separate accounting before the issue is resolved in the courts, probably in the U.S. Supreme Court, would reintroduce to the state the financial risk that was remedied by the passage of the 1981 Act. Mr. Chairman, every state revenue forecast which I've seen shows a continued decline in the level of those revenues over the next decade as the massive production from Prudhoe Bay begins to decline. This decline will be offset somewhat by added production from smaller fields, which we have discussed today. However, nothing on the horizon will be able to stop that revenue decline, and it is highly unlikely that any future discoveries will replace the magnitude of the revenues received from Prudhoe Bay. The fact of the matter is, the state of Alaska will have to operate on progressively less revenues as we move into the closing years of the 20th century. As I noted earlier, this bill seems to indicate that the desire of the legislature is to continually ratchet up the taxes on the state's most productive industry in an attempt to offset revenue declines. If that is really the case, the future will be bleak, indeed for both the oil industry and the people of Alaska, because this will be a self-defeating course of action. Its ultimate result will be to further reduce the long-term growth and revenues, leaving the people of Alaska with a massive government and few resources to pay for those massive governments. I encourage the committee and the legislature to soundly reject this bill and thereby reaffirm the stability of Alaska as a place for investment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Weaver, in 1981, did Exxon or the oil company supply the confidential information to then former Commissioner Williams to do his numbers? Because on the fiscal note that was provided to us on June 22nd of 81, and also the analysis on July 16th, 81, both showed they were confidential information as sources coming from other than the state administration.
We did provide confidential information. We have reviewed that, and based upon the outlooks for revenues and oil prices at the time, those were factual and accurate estimates.
Representative Cotton.
Mr. Weaver, I appreciate a couple of your opening remarks very much, having to do with stability and certainty, and those terms have become even more important to us, especially this year, as we've been seeing some of the problems that are associated with declining revenues, and I can appreciate that other companies have a similar situation. Although I'm not sure that you appreciate the problems we're having with trying to have some certainty and stability as well. Every place that we do collect money, if you will, for instance, 243.21, you're suing us. You're saying that we shouldn't have been able to collect those taxes during those years. Even though, as it turns out, you're doing quite a bit better under under the new provisions of law than you expected to do. The TAP settlement is another area that at least one of the companies admits that had been charging and been charging too much as a tariff on that. And we feel a little uncertain about that. We don't feel very stable about how that's going to turn out. Amarantha, Hess, and other litigation that surround every method and manner that the state collects taxes, you know, makes me feel very uncertain, and it makes the state, you know, have a hard time making a lot of decisions with any kind of certainty. So I can certainly appreciate where you are, but I feel the same way about operating state government.
If I may, Representative Cotton, I think the recount of the tax history from the late 60s to 81 that was given by Mr. Messenger recants a long series of tax changes which reflected a lot of changes which do create opportunities for litigation. I would say that your comments relative to us doing better under the tax bill than we anticipate, in view of the fact that the federal government is still receiving its fair share from Alaska revenues and the state is receiving substantially above the 30%, which was projected as the fair share of the state, the remaining revenues are the ones that come from the oil company, and I question whether we are doing better under that proposal than we thought. Relative to the settlement of the TAPS litigation, that, of course, is a separate issue which is under considerable discussion over the proper methods to assign that. And whereas one company has settled, others do not view that the actions taken do appropriately fit all of the circumstances, particularly the circumstances related to drops in tariffs in the 1981-82 timeframe.
But I think everybody agrees. I mean, it's pretty apparent that the companies that own the pipeline agree that the tariff is too high, and it's a matter of how low they're going to go on the settlement. The other thing I wanted to just real quickly touch on, Mr. Chairman, was this business about the 30% number, as though that was some sort of magic number that was agreed upon, that that as long as we got 30%, everything was fine. And that really wasn't what the joint statement by the legislature said. It was very clear, even in... I think Mr. Williams' article here in the paper the other day said it pretty well. There were several things, that the revenues would not be materially altered as a result of the change. That was the third factor in deciding that maybe that change wasn't such a bad idea, that the revenues would not be materially altered. And although we're having some difficulty finding out the most recent estimates, it's pretty clear that in 1981, when the bill passed, Mr. Williams's fiscal note showed that, you know, over a 4-5 year period, the total loss to the state was $141 million as a result of the change in law. And everyone since then has shown, as much as $3 billion over a 10-year period. Or the last time the Department of Revenue made an estimate, and I've got a letter from Mr. Vince Wright, who apparently is going to be testifying later. He shows that between those years there are, I won't add it up here in my head, but it's around $500 or $600 million difference. And so the information that the legislature made a decision on in 1981, there is apparently something wrong with it. And as a result, every examination since then has shown that as a result of that change in law, that the state received a heck of a lot less revenue than they expected to receive.
I suspect that is true. The state's received some in the neighborhood of $14 billion in the ensuing years. That's probably significantly less than the state was viewing at a time when there were increasing oil prices. And the analysis there is a very difficult one. What I am saying is that dramatic events relative to the world oil price situation have occurred since that point in time. None of our revenue projections, our companies, nor the states, are anywhere near what they were at that point in time. But if you look at a carving up of the pie, if you will, the state is certainly doing better than what it would anticipate. And I think that represents a fair share approach. And perhaps we have a difference there.
Well, I just close just by saying that I appreciate your response there, and that you know, I think that everybody in this room and everybody in the legislature is anxious for the oil industry to continue exploration in Alaska. We all realize that the state government counts on that income, and a lot of employment in Alaska and from other states are benefited by the oil industry in Alaska. We certainly don't want you to leave. We want you to stay here. We want you to continue to explore and develop oil. And we also recognize that if it was up to the industry to write their own tax law, that you'd probably be glad to do that. And that's what the function of state government, and that's why we're examining the laws around the books and some of the history that's taken place.
Well, I think the introduction of this bill certainly does not send us a message that you want us to stay around. And I think in the projections of the revenues over the states, one should look in terms of what remaining under the separate accounting procedure would have done to some of the developments such as Endicott, Lisbon, West End, EOR, and the numbers of revenues that those would generate, as well as the jobs and opportunities for Alaskans to be employed that those have brought forward. So it is not a fully separable issue, sir.
Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions, if I could. I asked Mr. Messenger about the 1981 proposed changes. And let me preface here that I would like an answer in language, because I don't understand all this oil taxation all that much, although I do remember quite a little bit about the history of it. And I do remember the joint statement made by Governor Hammond and the leadership of the House to Senate about what their goals were in the 1981 legislative session. And I asked Mr. Messenger to kind of recount those and the stability the taxation policy to this state. We were interested in the backstop provision, and there were 3 points that Mr. Messenger gave, which sounded all like pretty good, clear, legitimate concerns of treating major industry in this state fairly and establishing some stability so that we would know where we were going. Exxon is the party to the suit, of course, but I guess I'm wondering, and I don't know if you were around then or not, but perhaps you could answer this. Could you give me the underlying reasons as to why the oil companies opposed the proposal that passed House of Representatives, for example, and apparently opposed the statement that was made as the goals of the administration and of the leadership at that time?
I don't believe that you can say that the oil companies opposed the passage of that. The bill was not an adequate adjustment for us to drop the lawsuit relative to the years over which separate accounting remained in effect.
Why wasn't it an adequate adjustment?
I don't believe I'll answer that question, sir.
I beg your pardon?
I don't believe I have the information to answer that question, sir.
Could you provide me the information to answer that question?
I am not certain. I would have to visit with our attorneys relative to the lawsuit on that.
What you're telling me is it perhaps may be confidential because of the lawsuit?
It could be, and without consulting with my attorneys, I would not promise you to provide you information which I might not be able to do.
Can you answer as to why perhaps just the two changes in the proposal on the investment tax credit and the economic limit factor were enough to make the oil companies continue the lawsuit?
Well, it's pretty apparent in terms of the investments that we have made since 1981, which are in the multi-billion-dollar range, that 10% investment tax credit would represent a fairly sizable benefit that we would have received in that interim period, and the reduction of the economic limit factor, which I do not have calculated out, would have been substantial by this point in time off of the 15%. And the analysis on that time, given the price outlooks and other things that we had, clearly would have indicated that that was not a substantial enough concession by the state to allow us to proceed with dropping the lawsuit for the ensuing years.
Were you then looking for a substantial financial concession by the state?
We were looking for a settlement proposal which we put on the table and which the state rejected.
You expect that settlement proposal to include a substantial financial concession by the state?
It was a look in terms of the reductions of the tax burden, which there was a small amount indicated. Given the light that we had, there were some major items which we were looking for to encourage the investment climate that we had. Clearly, in the light of the people who were there at the time, that was not an adequate bill to justify the dropping of the lawsuit.
What would you consider a substantial financial concession?
I have not said that I asked for a substantial financial concession, nor could I prejudge what would have been in 1981. Our proposal was adequate.
I guess what I'm trying to find out is that my understanding is that people that were hired by the legislature to evaluate the proposed legislative changes indicated that the company proposals would cost the state between 1981 and 1985 $600 million. My other understanding is that the oil companies were saying that your proposal would cost the state very little. Is that correct?
I cannot say that that is the case. What I can say is that the companies made a proposal, and had the legislature accepted it, I think the companies would have dropped the lawsuit, independent of the financial notes that were attached thereto.
I think you can probably say a lot more than you'd like to. I'm not trying to argue with you, but I guess we are. But I think you can say a lot more than you'd like to. I guess I just get frustrated is that you want stability, and I think you should have stability. However, back in 1981, the stability that you wanted was a change. Your proposal. And what this is proposing is to go back to that 1981 era of stability, and you're opposing that. And I guess there must be some underlying reason why you really were pushing your 1981 proposal.
I guess I would ask you to look at the investments that have been made in the less economic fields of Alaska and the benefits that the state will derive from 1981 and say whether the state has not done well.
Well, I think the state has done well. How have the oil companies been?
We have suffered declines in revenues as a result of declining oil and gas prices.
I think the state's suffered declining revenues also.
Representative Maru.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Weaver, I appreciate your remarks. They're refreshing. I'd like to ask that you not paint us all with the same brush or in the same color. Some of us do, in fact, favor lower taxes and less government. And I would like to ask that you consider, at your convenience, and I've also talked to two other oil companies in the room, what you might think about a royalty incentive for discovery, such as what we had years ago. At your convenience, of course, not now, since we're discussing something else here.
Representative Davis.
Thank you. I have several questions. You indicated that you felt that the separate account, that you intend to take the separate accounting to the U.S. Supreme Court. At least that's your indication now. So I guess you feel that the separate accounting, at least for the state of Alaska, is not a fair tax. Do you have any proposals in Mississippi, Oklahoma, Louisiana to try to get separate accounting off the books? Is that an interest of yours in those other states, or is there any litigation? I'm not familiar with, maybe you don't do business in those states. I guess I have one other question, in that you said that there was an additional tax burden because of economic limit factor, and one other proposal which escapes me right now was an additional tax burden that you've had to pay, which has been substantial since 81. Do you have those figures? Do you know what kind of money we're talking about that you've incurred because of those things that have caused you to continue on with the lawsuit?
I do not have the figures available, but one could look in terms of what the reduction in the severance tax would have been had the ELF been applied during those periods of time, and we could calculate that and provide it to you.
I think
that would have to be provided under confidentiality because of the requirement on our numbers, but we will make those calculations, and given the appropriate confidential provisions, would allow you to see what that burden would be.
And the answer to my first question about separate accounting, do you
have some similar problems? I don't think it's appropriate for us to address the issues specific to the litigation. Relative to the separate accounting, our objective there, or our concern there, is the fact of a double taxation and the infringement of the Commerce Clause. And as applied by the state of Alaska, we view that the separate accounting law, which is encompassed in the present version, is unconstitutional.
Representative Thompson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I want to ask, first of all, what this bill, in your mind, would increase the state's fair share of total petroleum revenues to? As I understand it from your testimony, the fair share concept in 1981 was defined as being 30% of total petroleum revenues. What, in your mind, would this bill increase that share to?
As I said, we have not calculated the direct implications. It will increase the, it will, in essence, for 2 years, impose both the separate accounting and the increased severance taxes upon us. We believe that the state ought to adopt a posture and very carefully look at mechanisms of encouraging our industry for its investments rather than imposing additional tax burdens on us today or in the future.
Isn't it possible then, since you haven't run those numbers, that this bill would not increase that fair share to over 30%?
Since the numbers are substantially above 30% today and this will increase our tax burden, it's impossible for me to believe that.
You'll have to forgive me, I'm new to this and I'm not familiar with what the difference between 12.25 and 15% on the severance tax means in terms of dollars. Could you enlighten me that way?
Well, that's about 2.5% on the total crude stream coming out of Prudhoe Bay at 1.7 million barrels a day, and say, I don't know what the current legislative $17 a barrel netback. If you take 2.25% of that, that would, or 2.5%, that's what that represents. I can't give you that number off the top, but it's an easy calculation if you just take the production rate from the state, multiply it by 2.5% in the price of oil, which netbacks about $17. It's a substantial sum.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, two quick observations. I am one of 19 freshmen in the House. We're not privy to or party to these decisions in 1981. I'll speak for myself and just say that I assure you it's my intention to review this matter and come to a fair decision. But I would also point out to you that I have to disagree with your statement that this state is not a business. The state is a business, and we need to make business decisions. And while I certainly appreciate your comments about the necessity of fiscal restraint in a time of declining revenues, from my perspective, I think this is a question I've wanted to ask those who are involved in resource development for years, and you have to be the first opportunity I have to ask it. And the question is, whose resources are we talking about?
The resources which we are developing are ones which we leased from the state of Alaska under commercial terms at the time of lease. They are resources of which we have bought the rights to develop them. They are resources in the state of Alaska which we have purchased the rights to develop those under the basis of contracts which included for the bulk of Prudhoe Bay and most of the leases, about 12.5% royalty, as well as bonuses paid at the time to develop, prior to the time that it was determined that there was any reserves or anything there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis?
Yeah, just one issue that's pretty been discussed a lot down here is the issue of local hire, and you indicated to me that you were providing jobs for Alaskans, and you may not have that information, but I think we'd be real interested in finding out how many Alaskans work for the development that's taking place in the North Slope and how many are non-Alaskans. But I'm sure that's been asked.
Well, there have been studies done, and I believe that if you look at those studies, aside from the state government, which I assume has a higher percentage of Alaskans employed than others, the industry has a very high Alaskan percentage. Somewhere between 65 and 70, better than tourism, which has about 45% non-Alaskan people, certainly better than fish processing, which is down around the 23% Alaskan personnel. We have an aggressive program in terms of trying to have people, and in fact, a recent audit on ARCO, which Harold Hines might be better to reflect, shows that they have something like 98% Alaskans involved in their operations. I think the oil and gas industry is to be commended as opposed to being condemned for the number of Alaskans which we do have on our payroll.
Well, we do hear the reports of planes being full from Los Angeles going up to the North Slope. And the real concern of the people that I represent in Fairbanks that see and meet a lot of non-Alaskans working up in the North Slope. So if you have those figures, I'm sure it would be interesting.
Those statistics are certainly ones which have been developed and which we have made available, but we will certainly see that that information is provided to you. We can also provide you information that we have gathered for our own company, which generally shows that it's between 70 and 98%, depending upon the individual project of Alaskans involved in our activities.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver.
Thank you very much.
Do you have another question?
Yes. Yeah. Just one more question. The and I kind of want to go back to where I was at before. The two changes in the bill that finally passed that you folks didn't agree with was the economic limit factor and the investment tax credit. Is that correct?
I take issue about didn't agree. There has not been a lawsuit over the existing bill, so you can't say we didn't agree.
Well, let me,
those two factors did not provide the basis for us to settle the existing lawsuit.
So what I meant to say is if those two factors would have been in the bill, the lawsuit would have been settled.
That was the proposal that was put by the oil companies to the legislature and the administration, and I feel quite confident, at least for Exxon, had the legislature approved the bill that had been proposed by the oil companies, that lawsuit would have been settled.
I asked you again because I may. You can't or won't attach a monetary amount to those two provisions?
I do not have that number. I think the question that you asked me was to provide you what was the substantial amount of reductions that would have been required for a tax settlement, and I cannot give you that. I think that the numbers relative to what those two provisions cost are probably ones with the Department of Revenue, given the information that we provide you, provide the Department of Revenue, as well as the investments which they are privy to, could give an industry-wide number which would show what that was.
Well, I guess I'm really interested in finding out what the monetary amount of those two provisions were, the economic limit factor and the investment tax credit, and maybe not just monetary, but why else they were all that important, and maybe you could provide me with that information.
I guess the monetary amount is best obtained from the Department of Revenue.
I guess what I'm wondering is if they really are that important to you.
Those provisions were part of a negotiations to try to settle a lawsuit and establish a stable tax climate. And I don't believe that we can project ourselves back into 1981. Clearly, they were important enough not to settle the lawsuit because the lawsuit was not settled when they were not included. I mean, that is a fact of history.
Did you ever, and I don't know the answer to this question, did you ever propose after that that perhaps the legislature, if they go back and reconsider those two provisions, that you would then settle the lawsuit?
Having asked the legislature to establish the ground rules under which we could operate, we have operated and made major investments in Alaska since that period of time to bring added reserves on. We have not come back to the legislature, at least from Exxon, asking them to resolve the lawsuit relative to that issue. The legislature established a basis under which we have made investments. We have made substantial investments in the interim. Those will bring substantial revenues to the
been settled, we could have all been on good terms.
Mr. Cotton would have accused me of being from asking for tax stability. We had a tax bill in which we thought we could make investments to develop the reserves of the state. We were willing to operate under that. We have attempted to operate under. We've been given assurances by the administration and legislative leaders over the last 3 years that this was a favorable environment in which to invest, and we have done so to the benefit of both our industry and the state.
And also a tax bill that had substantial tax savings for the oil companies.
Yeah, I apologize for getting a little bit late here for this testimony, Mr. Chairman, but just reading through your written testimony, Mr. Weaver, and on page 4 I'm not sure if this question hasn't been asked, but you say, speaking for Exxon, I can say that we supplied accurate factual data to the department in 1981 using assumptions given to us by the department then. Just kind of a triggered my question is that, did they ask you the right questions?
Well, did they ask you to give you the right assumption involved that turned out to be what the oil price forecast would be, and we used the basis of what our operations would be under that oil price scenario and developed numbers. As the ensuing years have changed, we have had reductions in oil prices. As I point out later, we have taken substantial measures to change the way we have operated in terms of reducing manpower, shutting down refineries, doing a number of things in order to increase the operation efficiency of Exxon in the interim. So what I'm saying is that given where we were in 1981, doing what we were doing in 1981, given the price outlook for 1981, those were good numbers. The oil price changes have changed many things.
Yeah, I follow up, Mr. I just said, it was the phrase at the end of the sentence that struck me. It says you gave factual data to the department in 1981, and I guess if you had just put a period there, I wouldn't ask the question, but you said using assumptions given us to by the department.
Well,
my issue is, did the department ask the wrong questions?
Well, if we had used the price forecasts as of today, the numbers that we would have given in those years would be very different. And the reason for giving the assumptions is that 1981 was a very different climate in terms of what we would be doing and what we anticipated our cash flows to be than today was. And so when I would say, if I said accurate, I wanted to make sure that it was clear that was based upon what we knew at that point in time.
Yeah.
And that is different than what we know today, as we are painfully aware of.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess the question that we keep going back to is why was the figures that you gave us or that were given by your company were $141 million and the figures that we got subsequently in late, we're not talking 5 years from now or even 2 years later, we're talking at the same time we had figures of $600 million. And so that's the question that sort of reoccurred.
We did not give any number which represents 149 numbers. We gave numbers in terms of what the impact of various things would be upon us given the price forecast and other assumptions that were relevant at the point in time.
Right.
The department aggregated them. You know, all I can say is that the numbers we provided, the Department of Revenue, were accurate numbers based upon the information that was in front of us and our outlook for the future as we saw it in 1981.
I guess we have to find, we'll have to just sit down and study this and why your figures were so dramatically different than other figures at the same time. But back to this local hire information that you're going to provide. Could you provide that with, include the subcontractors that are also...
That's the way we do. We do not represent just Exxon. It is the people who have worked for us. And where we can accumulate the full set of data, for example, even in Exxon activities which are outside of the state in OCS waters, we have accumulated data in terms of what our activities are and who was involved. And as I say, the numbers run in the... 70 to 98%. Certainly, some of our geologists and others who are involved in trying to explore for and identify resources in Alaska who are resident outside, they count in the numbers as non-Alaskans, although they are involved in the exploration to find reserves in Alaska.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
At this time, the chair will call on George Nelson. Would you state your name for the record, please?
George Nelson.
I'm Wayne Tanner.
Mr. Nelson, I would like to apologize for you for not having my uniform or my costume for you to reflect on some of your remarks you made yesterday, but
I think you should remember that people, Alaskan people, also say the same remarks about oil industry, especially on a local higher status, and also Alaskan business to participate with oil industry development. So I say I apologize for not having my uniform on my costume to reflect your statement, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am George Nelson, president of the Ohio Petroleum Company. I'm here today because I am concerned about the future development of Alaska's oil reserves. I feel it's especially important that we as Alaskans understand the economics of bringing marginal fields into production. Alaska has a great deal of potential for new field discovery and development, but most of it, if not all, of these future fields are likely to be marginal. I would like now to talk about the Endicott project because it is representative of a marginal field in Alaska, which can be developed only if the economic climate will allow us producers to develop it profitably. The reservoir contains approximately 1 billion barrels of oil in place and about 350 million barrels of recoverable oil. The reservoir also contains about 1 trillion cubic foot of gas in place and about 800 billion cubic foot of recoverable gas reserves. Endicott will be the first offshore development in the Beaufort Sea. Production is also scheduled to begin in 1988, growing to a peak rate of about 100,000 barrels a day of oil. The cost of developing this field is in excess of $2 billion. We have, as you know, received the permits necessary to proceed with development of this field, and the work is now underway. Like Endicott, future projects will cause many sleepless nights amongst the engineers who must design development plans which provide the necessary financial incentive for development to go forward. But if any future development is to occur, it will happen only with the cooperation of all the stakeholders. Chief among the stakeholders is the state of Alaska. It is the state who will benefit from the jobs created by these projects, from the capital goods and equipment purchases made by the producers, from the taxes and royalties paid to the state on projects on state land, and from the state income taxes paid by the producers on projects on federal land. The bill, House Bill 353, now before you, will have a big impact on what future Alaska projects will go forward and which will be left undeveloped. This legislation is the proposed return to the separate accounting method of taxation in the oil industry. This method of taxation was imposed on the oil industry and only on the oil industry in 1978, but was repealed in 1981 after the industry had filed suit challenging the constitutionality of this tax plan. The legislature also felt that the cost of refunds if the state lost the suit was too high to accept from a risk management perspective. You will remember that Senate Bill 524 was a carefully drafted bill to define the appropriate share of oil revenues which should flow to the benefit of the state. Governor Hammond, when he signed Senate Bill 524, indicated that the new statute would preserve the state share of oil reserves at or above 30%. Other testimony here today has or will indicate that the share of state oil revenues has exceeded and is expected to continue to exceed 30%. But I would like to talk about Sohio's experience in Alaska. Since 1980, we have paid the state of Alaska nearly $5 billion in taxes, with an additional $3.3 billion in royalties for total payments to the state exceeding $8 billion. This is 2.5 times the amount we paid to our shareholders over the same period. Of the profits retained by Sohio after dividends over the same period, some 80% were reinvested in Alaska. While revenues from Senate Bill 524 have been significantly less than anticipated, most of the shortfall has been due to declining oil prices. When the state's share of oil revenues exceeds 30%, it must expect that revenues will decline during a period of declining prices. to compensate for this decline by increasing the state's share is unwise. To increase the taxes on oil production during a period of declining prices will negatively impact the development of future projects in the state. In addition to the economic issues involved with this bill, I must talk a moment about the legal issues. As you know, Sohai was one of the litigants in the Chapter 21 case. I should state that we do not believe a decision in the state's favor will be the end of the case. An appeal to the United States Supreme Court is almost certain. Enactment of this bill will provide additional impetus for the Supreme Court also to hear this case. Now I would like for you to look at what would have been the net effect on the state of Alaska if separate accounting had remained in place. It has been suggested that the state would make an additional $500 million over the past years. And as we've heard previously, that number has vacillated between up to as much as $600 million. Although we feel the impact was considerably less, let's for the moment accept this $500 million figure and pursue it a little further. What would it have cost the state to get the extra $125 million a year? In all probability, it would have cost the state the Endicott project. When we decided to go forward with this project, we did so with a firm belief and assurances from Juneau that the state tax policy would remain stable. The state of Alaska has a real interest in Endicott. In addition to the 12.25% severance tax on the production for the first 5 years and the state income taxes resulting from this project, the state stands to gain 12,500 barrels a day of Endicott royalty crude. The current value of Endicott royalty crude and the state severance tax amounts to some $135 million a year to the state treasury. And this total does not include the corporate income taxes, the property taxes on the project facilities, the capital expenditures made in connection with these projects, or the jobs provided and the wages paid to the Alaskan workers if these projects are developed. Clearly separate accounting at the cost of just one project like Endicott is a losing proposition for the state of Alaska. The supporters of this bill are under the assumption that future projects will go forward even under this onerous tax plan. That assumption is based on emotional wish and not economic fact. The legislature must recognize that the answer to this economic dilemma does not lie in strangling the one industry capable of providing the economic stability the state is seeking. It would be much better to either cut state spending or to encourage the industry to produce more oil. Cutting state spending is a political question, and I am not here to make a political speech, but I can tell you how to encourage more oil production. That solution involves encouraging the industry to expand exploration and production operations in the state. It means recognizing that the oil industry and the state have the same objectives, and to reach those objectives, we must, and I will repeat that, we must work together. And most important of all, it means a long-term, stable state tax policy. This means maintaining a stable tax environment over the long term that provides producers with the confidence that the economics upon which they make their investment decisions will not be disrupted. There are many oil fields in Alaska which may not be found, much less developed or produced, if a separate accounting tax plan is put in place. Thank you very much.
Do we have questions? President Szymanski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nelson, I've known you for some time now, and I've always enjoyed the conversations and meetings with you, but I think I share the chairman's concern that with regard to the reports or media reports of your remarks from yesterday associated with your reaction to the legislation and your description of dealings with the legislature, and quite frankly, I'm distressed with it. It's not, it's not my intent to do anything other than act in a responsible manner in dealing with the policies affecting the state of Alaska. And I'm just kind of curious as to what your feelings really are on that issue.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Szymanski. Yes, we've had many conversations, I have with the chairman as well as your Representative Szymanski and others in the membership of this meeting today. And I would think that probably there is no better group than you gentlemen and ladies sitting right here today that would know what it is like to have either the press or the electronic media, and in this case it was the electronic media, not the press, that can take something either out of context and or use it because it is some comment that they do not feel or they feel will create some interest. I was asked a question at the Resource Development Council yesterday morning, and the statement you were referring to was part of my response. What you did not hear on the media was the question that it was asked of me and the ongoing speech that I had made that brought that question about. The question I was asked had to do with whether I saw anything happening in the state to address the permitting delays and problems I had addressed in my text. I responded that there was a well-recognized permitting problem, that AOGA and I had met with the governor, with Commissioner Ross and other commissioners just the day before to discuss this and other things. I said that the state recognized the permitting problems and that they were working on trying to remedy this situation. I added that this problem had been around for a long time and that it would take quite a while to resolve it. I then said, I quote, "I spent 20 years overseas and worked with what I thought were some very difficult governments, including the good Colonel Gaddafi and his 13-man Revolutionary Command Council, with the Soviet Union as advisors, and I thought these people were tough to deal with until I came to Alaska," unquote. I might add that this last comment was intended to be humorous, and it was accepted that way by the audience. Also, the newspapers never picked up on it. And for a little bit more, Mr. Chairman, at the very first meeting I attended in Libya with the good colonel and his second-in-command, Mr. Jalloud, it was in a meeting room very similar to this, except on either side of someone like the chairman, there stood two gentlemen with machine guns. They set those down, and then we talked about oil prices. So I thank you very much for no machine guns. No, it was not intended whatsoever other than the way it was represented as a fact, and I think it's to your credit from the standpoint of, yes, the Libyan government was difficult to deal with, and they had very tough regulations and rules and different things that had to do with us developing the oil reserves in that country. And this is the same thing that we have here, as by viewed by this very meeting that we're having right now.
Representative Greenstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wasn't expecting your comments on permitting, but maybe my bill's looking better all the time here. In your testimony, you referred to incentives for exploration and production. This bill has been said to provide incentives for exploration. Do you feel that this bill does provide incentives for exploration?
No, sir. If I understand the question correct, you're saying the House Bill 353 that we're now discussing provides disincentive, and I think I stated that in a clear manner, simply because anything that you do to add additional tax burdens to the new marginal projects that will be coming up will add to the hurdle rate that we have to meet financially in order for it to be a viable financial investment for the company.
Is there a difference? I mean, technically, I'm sure there is, but in reality, is there a difference between an incentive for exploration as opposed to an incentive for production?
Well, it depends, of course, as how they set up the different exploration type of sales and what is in there, but the disincentive from the standpoint of a tax bill would be the same thing that has happened previously in other places of the world, and I'll try, Mr. Chairman, to not get in trouble again about that. But anyway, when tax bills have been introduced or taxation in other countries, you will find out that the expiration shifts and goes from one place to someplace else. Because there is no need to do the expiration, find something, and then not be able to have a stable type taxation or policy or the minimum number of variables to include when you do the financial calculations to find out what your acceptable rates of return are. So by virtue of that, it will discourage expiration. Yes, sir.
Is it safe for me to assume that unless we give you a corresponding production incentive, that the expiration incentive isn't much good unless it's an awful big incentive?
Well, it's just like anything else. Where there's a high return, there's a high risk, and I think we've exhibited that within the industry, that we're willing to take high risks and spend the money on exploration based on the fact that we do feel that there's a stable tax policy that we're looking at, so that if we do find something, that we can proceed with development and production, which is really the name of the game, and where we can then get a return on our investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sumner.
Just one question. You mentioned, and it comes up quite often, the buzzword economic climate, and that it has to be a good economic climate or a bad economic climate, whatever it is. Could you just relay for me what you feel the major factors that make up the climate of the economy? I mean, what are the four or five major factors that make a good economic climate?
Well, most assuredly, a stable tax policy does, of course. You know, you have to have a favorable investment environment, which means that you have to have stable tax policies. You also have to have opportunity, and there has to be the opportunity to be able to do the seismic work and some of the initial work that's to be done without a overburdening permitting process in order to be able to proceed. In other words, right now, in order to develop production in the state of Alaska, we're looking at somewhere between 10 to 12 years from the time that we initially start exploration work and have got the lease in our hands before we can bring production on. That same number in the lower 48 is running only from 4 to 6 years. So as you can see, that's part of the climate too, that we are having a problem, as we visualize it, with the regulatory process, the permitting process, as well as a stable tax atmosphere.
Good, Mr. Chairman. What portions of the economic climate that are the factors that are outside the state of Alaska that have any major effect?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, say that again. I'm not...
I mean, price obviously is a major factor. I mean, are interest rates a factor? Investment dollars a factor?
Well, of course. Excuse me. Go ahead.
No, I'm just trying to get a grasp. You have permitting policies and taxes as a factor. I just wondered what the rest of the equation is.
Well, most, Chairman, Representative, they, of course, the prices of the product that we're selling have a very large influence upon whether we do proceed with any type of exploration work and or development work. It is very possible that we could do exploration work and then the prices or something of that nature change, which is outside, which we have no control over, no more than you do, and that would affect what we do or whether we go ahead and proceed and develop or do not.
What's in your analysis now the lowest oil price that could come about that you could continue to develop in Alaska?
Well, it depends on each project. As I said before, there is a minimum hurdle rate that you have to get over, and then each project, according to the risk, will make that different.
because you can't say just one number for one project, or it has to be done on an individual case-by-case basis. And each company has its own individual minimum requirements for their financial hurdle rates, as well as they also have separate risk factors that they attach to that. So there's not a, you know, we may be able to produce one particular field with a lower risk factor at a lot less price than we can another one. For instance, Prudhoe Bay is, we spent $15 billion, $9 on the pipeline, $6 in developing the field so far for 1.5 million barrels a day. That's only $10,000 a producing day barrel. And with respect to Endicott, you're only going to get 100,000 barrels a day for $2 billion. That's double that, or $20,000 a producing day barrel. So it all depends on what kind of a project you're looking at, and each case is different.
Thank you both for your time. It's time the chair would call up Phil Holdsworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Phil Holdsworth, and I'm here today on behalf of the Resource Development Council. I should note that this statement, which I'm presenting, was drafted and adopted by the Executive Committee of the Council on Wednesday evening at their meeting, and was telexed down to me to present, being a member of that Executive Committee. I have served on the Executive Committee of RDC for 2 years, and have assisted them in developing the organization's policies on a number of issues. One of seven programs being undertaken by the Council is that of fostering a favorable tax environment for entities operating in our state. In fact, a separate policy statement on taxation of Alaska industries, which a copy has been attached to the statement, has been repeatedly adopted by our State Board of Directors. This emphasizes the importance of our state's tax environment to this broad spectrum of Alaska's leaders responsible for the Council's policies. A major provision of our Council's tax policy is that no specific industry be singled out for special tax burdens. House Bill 353 appears to do just that. Any tax increase is a disincentive. For that reason, we must strongly oppose advancement of this bill. There are several other reasons we oppose altering tax policy at this time. One, we do not believe you have had time for a careful analysis of the long-term impacts of a decision to adopt separate accounting on the industry that now provides virtually all of the state's income. And as an aside, Mr. Chairman, I might add, being here at this meeting today, I believe that you are attempting to get that information put together. After listening to the first hour and 45 minutes of the testimony given here, I think you've had a pretty good indication to help you along in your decisions. Two, we do not believe the citizens of Alaska would support still another tax on the state's most important industry. Three, the recent stable investment climate that has evolved from no tax changes in the last 3 years would once again be jeopardized, affecting not just the oil industry, but other industries as well. The legislature must understand the importance of the word stability to industry's investment decisions. We do not argue the fact that it may be advantageous from an overall investment standpoint for the legislature to study alternatives to the worldwide combined reporting method of taxation. We do, however, question the advisability of a shoot-from-the-hitch approach of addressing the issue from the standpoint only of one industry, especially on such short notice. The Resource Development Council has advocated in speeches throughout the state over the past year other means of addressing the declines in state revenues, including spending less money. We are working diligently with a number of communities to find ways of generating new sources of revenue because we believe this is the best approach for the long term. Just as important as reducing state spending and generating new sources of income is the need to find and produce more oil. Whether on state or federal land, onshore or offshore, it is in the state's best interest to encourage new exploration and production. Raising taxes is counterproductive to that goal. We'd like to remind you that House Bill 256, which recently passed the House, declares, and this is a quote, "It is the policy of the state to provide a stable tax and regulatory climate that encourages expansion of the state's economic base. We urge you to uphold that policy." As a statement, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Samaski.
Thank you. Appreciate your remarks, because I think that they're shared by many of us, and I assume that you've analyzed the bill 353 before you came before us today. Is that correct?
Not to any great extent. I've been involved primarily with the mining and lands issues.
Have you read the bill?
Although I might. Yes, I have. I might add that I was a cabinet member of territorial and state government from 1952 until 67, and was responsible for all oil and gas legislation. Let me ask you this. I am well familiar with the situation.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that the accounting procedure that the state imposes on all industries should be fair and equitable and be uniform?
Their resource-producing industries,
should they?
All of them on the resource-producing side could very well be under that sort of...
Do you think that that's the policy we should strive for?
There is one exception to that, which I've fought for over the years, and that is to remain under the mining license tax, which is a net profits tax mining.
But, I just read your testimony that what you were concerned with was ensuring that all industries are treated equally, and I just want to reconfirm that that is the strong position of the Resource Development Council.
Yes.
It is. Mm-hmm. And that this policy, whatever policy we craft, should be one which treats all industries and resource industries equitably. Is that correct?
Resource producing industries, yeah.
Could you point to me exactly what do you think the tax impact is going to be related to this?
No, I would have no. I've stayed out of the oil business for.
But you said
quite
that
a
you
while.
Believe that there is a tax impact.
There is.
And.
Yeah, I think the testimony, the factual testimony that's appeared before you earlier is pretty well straightened.
Have you ever heard of a flat tax, which would be a flat tax on all industry? In other words, just a flat tax on all industries where it would be inequitable, whether it's 15, 20, 30%, 5, whatever, where we treat all industry equitable?
Well, when you speak of a flat tax, you'd have to be speaking in the terms of an income tax. If you start talking about a tax on production of a resource, that's something entirely different. You couldn't treat all industry the same on that basis.
You shouldn't treat all industry the same. We should tax one differently. But could we establish, if we could establish one for all production industry, would you think that would be a more proper way to go?
I don't think that I can answer your question very satisfactorily.
Thank you.
I don't understand really what you're...
Well, you were indicating that we ought to have a consistent tax practice for all the industry, and I'm just curious as to whether or not you would advocate for a
a flat universal tax for all producing industry, mineral industry, if you want to call it this production industry, whatever, and whether or not everybody pay the same rate.
Person Cotton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your remarks in the Resource Development Council. I noted a little bit of a little opening here that was interesting. That we do not argue the fact that it may be advantageous from an overall investment standpoint for the legislature to study alternatives to the worldwide combined reporting method of taxation. That's really what this whole discussion is all about, whether or not to consider the in-state profitability or whether to consider the worldwide profitability. It looks like the Resource Development Council feels that it may be worthwhile to study that. I'm not sure exactly what you're trying to say there, though. Well,
Mr. Chairman, if I might speak to that, I discussed this with them over the phone and asked them the same question, what their position was on this, and what they intended to mean here was that you might back off from the worldwide and go to, say, as they say, waterline to waterline, and in other words, remain within the confines of either the North American continent or the United States or whatever, review it from that viewpoint other than international.
Or perhaps even within state boundaries?
They didn't go that far.
How about this for a possible idea? What if we proposed a lower tax rate for everybody? Like right now, the corporate rate is 9.4%. What if we said, let's go to 7%, but let's count everybody's in-state income? How do you think other industries would respond to that?
Well, I don't know of any industry really that's in the same category with the oil and gas industry, petroleum industry.
That's the
mining
problem
isn't treated. Mining isn't treated in the same manner. What other resource industry do you have that you're taxing in a similar manner?
Well, the people that operate under 4320, if they're a corporation, they pay a 9.4% tax. So what I'm suggesting is let's go down to 7%. Let's tax in-state profitability. Let's not be concerned with what they're doing in Libya or in Russia or wherever else the industry happens to operate.
This would be confined strictly to the corporate income tax. It wouldn't be involved in the tax, the other taxes that are applied on the resources, production, and so on.
Well, we're talking about income tax. Yeah. I mean, when you talk about income tax, you're talking about a net tax, which is what the industry, the resource industry seems to prefer. And instead, what we've done since in 1981, we increased the gross tax, or we increased production tax, we've decreased income tax on net. So, that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Holdsworth. You've been a long-term servant of the state of Alaska and service all. I was wondering if you think you'd change your testimony if let's say the state of Alaska won at the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, that they could, that separate county was a just tax, and then we won at the federal level, at the federal Supreme Court. Think you'd have any difference in the way you felt about the state of Alaska going back to separate county?
Well, the law is the law. As I say, not having been involved with the industry, and I certainly wouldn't feel that I could respond to that unless that question was treated or considered by the executive committee. As long as I'm speaking for them, of course.
This is hinged on a favorable settlement by the state Supreme Court.
Yeah, I understand what would happen.
The other thing that, and it's certainly something that we hear a lot about a stable tax policy, but have to understand too that we have a $2 billion tax liability, and so there's not a lot of stability in our taxing methods right now with that $2 billion tax liability against us. There's some instability right there, and I think it's been illustrated and talked about a little bit. You don't need to respond to that.
Representative Sun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I knew this this was going to come back to haunt me someplace, but you've got this resolution we call House Bill 256 in here, and I think Representative Cotton is out of the room, but the bottom of page 2, there's the policy statement in there, and I think I was a co-sponsor on this, but it is the policy of the state to provide a stable tax and regulatory climate that encourages expansion of the state's economic base. That issue was raised here in finance, I believe. I wasn't here regarding House Bill 353, and Representative Cotton, maybe you can respond. What the answer, maybe Representative Ringstead could respond, but my understanding was is that this policy statement didn't affect this bill that we have in front of us.
I think that the record will show that, Mr. Chairman, that I asked Representative Ringstead, does that mean that we shouldn't ever adjust our taxation policies? And I think his answer was no, that it doesn't mean that. But now, maybe somebody else remembers it differently, but I'm sure we can dig out the table.
I just wanted to get that on the record, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Once every 3 or 4 years, in 4 years.
The next person I'll call is R.L. Marler.
Yes, sir.
He said once every 3 or 4 years. It's been 4 years.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, sir. My name is Richard L. Marler. I'm tax counsel for Marathon Oil Company, a cook and a producer. I'm here today as the chairman of the tax committee for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. I'm here to present testimony on behalf of the companies that are in the AO during opposition to HB 353. HB 353 would repeal the modified apportionment for income tax provisions of 4320, which were enacted by SB 524 and 81, require the companies to go on a separate accounting income tax methodology, which is in effect from 78 to 81. The constitutionality of that statute, of course, is currently before the courts, and I will not address that any further since we've had an elaboration already. But there are other aspects of the HB 353 which members of the AO are severely concerned about. And I guess the old adage is, you've been told and told again, and I'll tell you what they've told you. And that means that we're concerned about the tax climate that would change with result of the HB 353 and the impact of that change on investment. Being chairman of the tax committee, I have seen since 1982, the first year with which SB 524 was applied, a very great air of cooperation between the industry and the Department of Revenue. We have worked with those people getting regulations, getting interpretations, and various other aspects of 524. So at this point in time, we find that we do have and very well understand just exactly where we fit into the taxation policy of the state. Now, the current problem is because of a anticipated shortfall in oil-related revenues to the state into the future. And those anticipated oil-related revenues are directly related to the significant decline in world prices that began in 81, 82, and have continued up to now. Because the state collects a royalty of 12.5% and a production tax of up to 15%, a property tax of 2%, and a state income tax of 9.4%. The fiscal well-being of the state is directly tied and linked to the economic well-being of the companies, the producers. Now, this is a legislative policy. It's nothing that the companies had anything to do with. It's a legislative policy. The decline in world prices has caused a significant decline in revenue to the Alaska producers. And we believe that since the oil industry has had to bite the bullet, so to speak, and reduce capital budgets and operating costs, that the only way that you can significantly do that here is to look hard and make hard decisions on reducing the expenditure level of the state level. The central theme of the Alaska administration and legislature, when it reiterated during the discussion of 524 in 1981, was that the